let's take something like marijuana use, okay? And it's becoming more and more accepted, more and more legal. But let's say you're in your 50s and you came up in an era of say no to drugs. And so you have a policy in your heart and mind against it, against marijuana use, let's say. And you in your heart of hearts, you feel like it's wrong, but now there are younger people coming up and maybe even some people who are influential and they feel like there's nothing wrong with it, recreational use of it, etc. Okay. And what would be the easy thing to do? Because in your mind, not only do you have some sort of moral or conscientious aversion to it, but you also see that it's potentially harmful maybe to somebody who's looking up to that leader. And so how do you nip it in the bud?
You make a good law, right? Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast,
where
we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. And we're doing a series called The Voice of the Shepherd, and we're talking about what it means to hear the voice of the gospel in daily life and apply it, live it out. And we guess this is maybe our third episode now. We're going to continue to develop the sort of the foundation, which is like going into passages in Scripture and looking at how they lived it out, like how they worked it out, how they understood the gospel to apply in ethical dilemmas. Right, Nathan?
Yep. That's not the whole point. We're going to actually, at some point, we're going to get in and try to do that thing, but you really need to lay a foundation and establish what it looks like to exposit the gospel into life. I think we're used to reading the New Testament as basic instructions before leaving earth. We see that Paul will make a pronouncement on something or encourage a behavior, discourage another behavior.
And there's our commands. We're supposed to just do that.
And we just take it as a prescription, as a law, as a thou shalt not. And we don't notice that there's all kinds of leading up that he really does set those instructions in a context that is the gospel and that he draws from the gospel for his proclamations.
He's working out the gospel.
And very different.
And therefore those
Moses.
Passages. Yeah. Okay. So Moses is prescription. Moses is law.
Right.
Paul, what we're seeing in these passages, and it's not just Paul, but Paul maybe is primary, but we're seeing a description of what it looks like to apply the gospel.
Yeah, and an exposition that there's a background, there's a basis, there's a meaning and a reason for the kinds of instructions that Paul gives in the New Testament. That, you know, you get to Mount Sinai, let's go back to Moses, and God goes, boom, 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 you know, and then he says, thou shalt not, thou shalt not.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a whole lot of reason. I guess the closest thing we get to some background is to the instructions that we find in the Levitical and the Mosaic covenants are things like, I am holy, so you should be holy.
Mm-hmm. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt.
That's it.
You shall have no other gods before me.
Right.
So that's the gospel before the commands.
Yeah.
But the law seemed to function more as command.
Yeah.
And do this and you shall live.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of it just had to do with, you know, God is powerful and he wants you to do this and you don't even need to understand it. I mean, some of those commands to this day seem very arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And maybe they even are to some degree in terms of morally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't fathom why it's morally wrong to boil a kid, a goat, in its mother's milk. I don't need to know the reason for that. You know, there was probably some background, some context, something that was based in the practices of the Canaanites at the time. Who knows what it was? We don't. Uh-huh. But the fact that we don't means that there wasn't a lot of explanation given. And it doesn't translate into today. So, you know, so a lot of these instructions that you get were just do it. And that there's a drive in the human that would to obey that instruction is to begin to abdicate one's moral center. Now, that isn't necessarily terrible if your primary concern is for order in a society. that you know you can count on at least somebody in that society to do something terrible. And so the best thing to do is to superintend them so that the society endures, okay? But the individuals don't really flourish or become something that they're supposed to be. And there's no way for them to know the difference between whether they're doing something as a good person or whether they're doing something as just an observant person. And that
because they could be doing that from fear of punishment.
Yes.
Or for conformity to
ostracism. Mm-hmm. You know, that because if you spend any time with Hasidic Jews or people who are very obviously objectively conforming to a religious standard, it's very easy to know, like, that there's ways that you dress, ways that you behave, ways that you eat. It's very easy to detect who is in that group and who is not. That there's a culture that comes along with it. But in doing that, the genius of God is that he made them peculiar. This idea of being holy, set apart, is to be peculiar in some way. But in doing that, he also gave them these signals for insider status that began to create these dynamics, right? And I think Paul saw that in himself. I think that's why he became, and this gets to our topic for today, antinomian. And
that means against law.
Right, right. And the reason I wanted to really begin this conversation or really get into this conversation, I think we began it a couple episodes ago, but the reason I really wanted to get into this discussion of Paul as antinomian is because there are great thinkers, and throughout my history is I've had people that I admire and I've learned from, but none of them would admit that Paul is antinomian. And so they would say, well, now, you know, Paul, you know, he says this and this, but he's not antinomian, of course. And that's a very hard sell if you just read the New Testament. Maybe, you know, and again, these people were very educated and maybe they're smarter than I am. I'm happy to be taught in this regard. It wouldn't be the first time I've had a massive paradigm shift in my faith. But from what I can tell, Paul is very clearly antinomian in the term, in the sense that he is against prescriptive rules. And I base that not just on the things he says overtly, like, you know, you're not under the law, but under grace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Romans 6, what is it, around verse 24 or 14. You know, sin will have no power over you because you are not under law, but under grace. That seems very clear to me to be saying that law is no longer in effect. That this, however we understand the Mosaic system,
mm-hmm.
the system of rules with rewards and punishments assigned. Okay? So when I say law, that's what I mean. A system of written rules with rewards and punishment assigned. Okay, that's how we normally see law. Okay, Paul seems to be against that, and I would like to, maybe if we have somebody who's educated in these matters and can argue from Scripture, you know, I'd really like to have a good juicy debate on, you know, why you think that Paul was not antinomian, that why he was pro retaining some rules.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, initially, I think someone who's really read, say, Romans a number of times would recall things that he says, like, do we then overthrow the law? By no mm-hmm. means, we uphold the law.
Right.
So he says, does this mean the law is evil or sin, right. that the law is sin? He says, right. by no means. Rather, it's good, it's righteous, it's holy. So,
yes.
So, and I know you know that, so for our listeners' sake, maybe you could clarify. You're not saying Paul thought the law was evil or bad.
Right. All right. He said, well, and he makes the case, and he goes to great pains, and I think that's why we need to have this conversation, because of all of the hard work that went into Paul's position on this. And I say hard work. What I mean is that any time you're shepherding a group of people, like say you have 20 or 30 people who are looking to you as a leader, and they're in some sort of community with each other, okay? So you have a drive and an instinct, I think, if you're a good leader or a caring leader, a shepherd, as you know, we kind of look at that language, an under-shepherd, I guess, to Jesus. And your concern is that they are going to have some tranquility, that there's going to be fair play, that they're, you know, people are going to care for one another, that they as individuals are not going to begin some sort of a slide morally into destructive behaviors and things like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's just take something like, and maybe we'll get into this as an issue later, but let's take something like marijuana use, okay? And it's becoming more and more accepted, more and more legal, but let's say you're in your 50s and you came up in an era of say no to drugs, and so you have a policy in your heart and mind against it, against marijuana use, let's say. And you in your heart of hearts, you feel like it's wrong, but now there are younger people coming up and maybe even some people who are influential and they feel like there's nothing wrong with it, recreational use of it, etc. Okay. And what would be the easy thing to do? Because in your mind, not only do you have some sort of moral or conscientious aversion to it, but you also see that it's potentially harmful maybe to somebody who's looking up to that leader. And so how do you nip it in the bud?
You make a good law, right? Yeah, let's just legislate this thing.
Right. And it seems so solid. It just seems like we'll just say, no, that is out of hand. That's absolutely. And while you're doing that, maybe we should start to ask, well, there are some other things. You know, I noticed some of these girls are dressing kind of skimpy. You know, and I don't think that's good for these, mm-hmm. these boys that are coming up.
And while we're at it, let's regulate the phone usage.
Right. No, that is a good one. But we know that people, or at least our instinct is to think that people need a line. We need to know when we're doing well and when we're doing poorly. Mm-hmm. So we know what we're going to say is that no use of any non-pharmaceutical medication. So, you know, obviously you get a THC pill and we're fine, right? No use of non-pharmaceutical medications or no use of recreational drugs. I mean, obviously you can never be consistent with these kinds of rules. You can say hemlines have to be at your knee. You have to wear full sleeves. I mean, you know, if you've ever been to a Bible college, you know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about. These are right there. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're talking about a Bible college, okay, or a seminary, you went to seminary. I don't know if seminaries have rules or not. But you as whatever you are, right, the chancellor of the college, and let's say you have a seminary in Colorado, right? And if somebody comes to visit your school, your seminary, and, you know, the Bible students are standing around under the tree toking it up, you know, what does that look like for you? Right, you know, is whoever's paying for this person's education going to bring their kid there? Mm-hmm. You start having some concerns, you know. The idea that there's that Bible colleges are probably the most restrictive legalistic places on earth says something about our view of law.
Mm-hmm. Right. Christians believe we're law is good.
We do. Like
we can really use some good laws.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's preferable. Uh-huh. You know, it's better than not law. And, mm-hmm. and there are some people who are institutionalized, you know, some people who just love that, who are just like, yes, thank you, finally, you know, and they feel better about themselves because they're part of a group of people who they know, at least they think, don't do X, Y, and Z, and they do X, Y, and Z, and look at us, we're doing well. Mm-hmm. And someone's given us a mark to tell us that. You see how appealing it is. Now, and so that's why I say that Paul, very early in this gospel experiment, is dealing with so many loose ends flapping in the wind. You know, I don't think we fully appreciate the kind of permeable layer around the Christian community in Paul's day. That knowing who was in and who was out was a bit fuzzy. Mm-hmm. You know, are you a Jew who just comes here on Sunday because you're curious? Are you a Gentile who, let's say you're interested in mystery cults, but, you know, and this one happens to be intriguing to you? You know, why are you here? What is it you really believe? And so Paul, like in Romans, when he says, hey, I want to come and I want to share with you this gospel. And it's like, wait, you're writing to Christians? And he's like, yeah, but you need to hear the gospel so that you could be established. Mm-hmm. Like there's this this sense that everybody's floating, that they're kind of in between, they're unsettled. And Paul, I think, and any of the Christian leaders, if we read the works in the New Testament, the tendency, I think, would have been to just say, okay, let's just give some rules. I mean, you see that in Acts 15, where, you know, some Judaizers are coming through and telling people they have to be circumcised, etc., and that's a bridge too far. But then they do give them a list of prohibitions, mm-hmm. you know. So don't eat, drink blood, you know, eat anything with strangled, and commit fornication. I don't know why they picked those three, you know, but it seemed to be important or helpful to them at the time. And so you might say, well, there's a list of arbitrary rules in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And yet nobody bothers to even think about it. I mean, the fornication thing, because it's mentioned somewhere else, but I don't know how many times have you ever been in a debate where somebody's asking, could you eat blood sausage?
Right.
Or do you need to be careful about what butcher you go to?
Doesn't come up.
Right. Yeah. How was this killed? You know, maybe it's just too much trouble, you know, for us to worry about those kinds of things. But for the church in Jerusalem speaking kind of ex cathedra out to the Gentile world, two of the three prohibitions are related to food laws. Where do we even get that, you know? So there seems to have been some sort of a legislative approach, but it was in a pastoral context. Like, you in your particular setting right now, for the sake of the gospel and the way it looks to the watching world, mm-hmm. please don't do these things. Mm-hmm. You know, not if you do this, you'll burn in hell, but if you do this, you'll do well. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real difference there between, you know, God will be angry with you and he will judge you on the last day, or you will flourish. Mm-hmm. And so those are very different approaches, I think, to prescriptions.
Somewhat more descriptive practice of law or legislation. Like, mm-hmm. here's what it's going to look like for you to live out the Christian faith.
Right.
In your context. It's going to look like these things.
Yes. Right. And so I think as pastors, we can give those kinds of things. We can say, hey, I think it's best if you don't do this and you do that, as, say, spiritual guides or whatever. But that's always from a perspective of spiritual wisdom and not from a perspective of legislative power. You know, like, don't do this or mm-hmm. you'll be ostracized or whatever. It's just, this is going to cause you to flourish as an individual, as a community. And you know what? Those kinds of instructions are, they're self-enforcing, but they're also self-negating. So if we do it and we flourish, then that's good. And we're glad we received that advice. If we do it and we, you know, we suffer as a community and we begin to decline and individuals are suffering, then we can say, whoa, okay, obviously, this has reached its expiration date. Culture around us has changed. The people in our midst have changed. Things have changed enough that we need to say, okay, this is foolishness to just keep doing this when it doesn't work. When the whole point of the instruction was, this will work. This will help. You will do well. If we do it and we don't do well, that tells us this instruction has reached the end of its life. Mm-hmm. And there's new guidance mm-hmm. that needs to come up. So I hope that makes some sense. It doesn't, and I know that maybe to some people that would sound very dangerous.
A pragmatic use of law, mm-hmm. And Paul honored God's law, mm-hmm. but believed that its time had come because God had now done something that would actually make people right. righteous.
Right. Well, and so Paul can't go through and say, well, the law is flawed and we need a better system. You can see that that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And this is where I call out, you know, latter-day revelation, again, Islam, Mormonism, those that would say, well, the previous revelation has decayed, has fallen into ruin, and you need a new revelation. So only listen to the parts of the previous revelation that agree with what I'm telling you now. Maybe lean on the previous revelation for some sort of authority to authorize what I'm telling you, but also be suspicious of it and discount it and, you know, treat it a la carte based on what I'm telling you now. That's problematic, right? God either gave us something flawed or he was unable to protect it and allowed it to fall into ruin, which, you know, Muhammad was, what, 6th century, right? That's a long time. If God couldn't protect his law before, how do we know he's protected it since then? Especially when it's a, you know, Muhammad was riding on everything from a palm leaf to a saddle to a horse's backside. You know, we don't really know just how well that was preserved and cataloged by his followers. If you're going to critique the Bible from that perspective, then we could also critique the Quran, since, as far as I know, nobody has the originals in his handwriting. So how do we know, right? It's traveled through people who had their own agendas and was compiled by someone who had their own agenda. And in many cases, many Muslims around the world would have to count on translation. I know that they try to get people to know Arabic and stuff like that, but even then, it's a living language. We can't possibly know that this word means the same thing today as it meant in the 6th century in a living language like Arabic. So all that to say, Paul couldn't come along and say, well, I've got a new book, you know, and that's how we write the narrative in our mind, that we think, well, these guys came along and they updated the revelation and they've got a new book and it's essentially the same, but with both better rules. And that's just, I don't know if we can recognize or appreciate how problematic that would have been to say, the book that you have is flawed, let me give you a new one. And that doesn't seem to have been the intention, especially since it wasn't until, you know, the Athanasian Canon, what was it, 363, that these books were stitched together and, you know, we determined this is, these are the authorized.
Took several hundred years to make the New Testament.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, that's a long time to go. It's longer than the entire history of the United States. Mm-hmm. So these people were without any
sort of... And yet we look back to the quote-unquote early church as the example.
Yeah, right.
They didn't have the New Testament.
Right.
Until hundreds of years later.
Right, but when you see Paul confronting this, because he does confront it, and that's what I like, and that's what I want to point out, is that he argues with himself in his letters, you know? So he'll make this case, this antinomian case, and he'll say, like you mentioned, not that we discount the law, not that the law is evil, and then he'll go on and explain. And so I want to make this case that Paul had every opportunity to resort to the law, or to maybe audit it and take pieces of it, but he seems to find a way forward that is not a retreat to being under the law. So let's take Romans, the end of chapter 3 that you mentioned. So not that we discount the law, but no, we uphold it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if we just stop there, and that's another problem that we have, is sometimes, you know, our book's chopped up into chapters and verses, and we miss the continuity sometimes between the chapters. So you get into Romans chapter 4, verse 1. He says, so what should we say that Abraham, our father, according to the flesh, has discovered? If he was saved by works, would he not have, he would have had something to boast in, but not with regards to God. And then he goes into this whole discussion about how the scriptures make the case that justification is by faith. You know, so he's saying, yeah, we do uphold the law. By the law, though, Paul means all the scriptures that he had. And so he's going into the story of Abraham and how Abraham was justified by faith and has become the father of those of faith. And David, you know, here you almost have bookends of the great founders kind of this nation, right? David seems to be the last exemplar, you know, and Moses the first. So you almost have a bookends of Israel's, I wouldn't say golden age, because there's a lot of crud in the middle there, but, you know, these people that hold this covenant, these covenants that must be maintained and then are embodied and fulfilled in Messiah. So Messiah holds the Abrahamic covenant. He holds the Davidic covenant, right? That these are cornerstone people. Paul draws from both Abraham and David. You know, David pronounces a blessing on the one whose sins are forgiven, right? He says, how blessed is the one whose mm-hmm. sins are forgiven, whom the Lord will not count sin. Mm-hmm. And he's saying this blessing is proclaimed not on the one who performs the law, because they wouldn't need it, you know, but on the one who has faith. And then he talks about how God in Genesis 17 proclaimed Abraham to be the father of many nations. I've made you the father of many nations. And so he's making his case from the law, right, following there in Romans 3. He's not building law back up. As a matter of fact, he comes out at Peter, who retreats to the law, apparently, in Galatians 2. And when we see that Peter says, before certain came down from James in Galatians 2, Peter used to eat with the Gentiles. But when those who were from, you know, Judea came down, he retreated back and refused to eat with the Gentiles. So I called him out in front of everyone. And I said, if you who are, you know, claim to be a Jew, you live like a Gentile, how do you compel these Gentiles to keep Jewish customs? Right? So, you know, he's just saying, look, living like a Gentile means you are not consistent in your ethical matrix. You know, so here's a Jew who would say, I live with integrity. I don't just blow around with the wind. I don't just conform my behavior to what's expected of me, but I live a consistent life. That makes me a Jew. And Paul says, really? This doesn't seem very consistent, Peter. You seem to be adrift. Now, just because you are being knocked around by the expectations of a set of religious people doesn't make you any better than a Gentile who would conform to peer pressure and be a social chameleon wherever he may be, right? That makes you exactly the same. Now you're trying to make them, you're indicting them for not keeping up with these food laws and stuff. And it's just like, you've just shown them that does no good morally. Okay, and then he says, you want to know who the sinner is? He says, if after I began to follow Christ, I find myself to be a sinner, does that mean that Christ is the author of sin? No way, by no means. He says, you want to know what makes someone a sinner? When they transgress themselves. He says, if I begin to build up what I've torn down, I have become a transgressor. So Paul does not retreat to a legal approach to God. He won't, he doesn't. To him, it's almost a cardinal sin, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we have to understand is that however we read the New Testament, however Paul, when we see Paul saying stuff like, you know, I'm under the law in this way or whatever, that we have to understand in a broader context, he's not retreating to a system of rules predicated on rewards and punishments. That's the one thing he will not do. Mm-hmm. So and as we get into this idea of the voice of the shepherd, what we have to understand is that he's somebody who is affirming an ethical standard apart from that approach. And that's what the voice of the shepherd is. It is this new ethical standard. So Paul says in Romans 7, he says, through the body of Christ, you've died to the law that you might be joined to another. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what we're arguing for in this series is that we have a faith that is law-free, but not ethic-free.
Right. Right, and not lawless.
It's not lawless, yeah. But it's law-free.
Right, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right, because lawlessness is seen throughout the New Testament as wrong, right? So John would say all sin is lawlessness. Mm-hmm. Okay, and Paul talks about the coming of the evil one in 2 Thessalonians, who is the man of lawlessness.
So this is like, lawlessness is not guided by an ethical standard.
Right.
It's guided by, instead, your passions and desires.
Yes. Yeah, an external ethical standard. So I think about, like, because Paul would say that, let's say, even the Roman Empire was not lawless in that they were under principles and their authorities enforced what he would say was good, okay? Just the common flourishing, well-being, fairness, that's what laws are there to do, okay? Now, if you can get to that, if you can get to that fairness, you can get to that those outcomes, without prescriptions, then that's even better, okay? But you're still wanting to get to a place where the individual is concerned for the whole. When the individual only cares for the individual without concern for the whole, now you have chaos, okay? And so that's something that we would want to avoid at all costs. That's, Paul would say, that's the other ditch that we don't want to fall into. So that's why it's important, I think, to talk about how the gospel is an ethical standard, because what we really, I think, what all of us should want, and I think what Paul wanted for the churches and stuff, was that they would become people who would transcend the common Jew of their day. Mm-hmm. You know, that their ethics would be superior in some way. So Jesus says, if your righteousness doesn't, you know, exceed that of the Pharisees, mm-hmm. then you can't enter. You're not mm-hmm. part of our right. group. So there's something about Pharisaic righteousness that just didn't make the cut. And it's not just that it wasn't authentic. It's that it was minimalistic. It was an attempt to just do what one had to do and then to retain as much evil as you could, you know, greed or whatever that. And that's really what law does. When it gives you that line, then you try to get as close to it as possible. You try to work the system, find ways around it, and still claim to be in conformity. So it has that corrosive influence. And I think that the difference would be that instead of giving people a line, that the gospel gives people a direction.
Okay.
You know, so instead of having this kind of if you can imagine a horizontal line that says don't cross this.
Don't cross this line.
Right. And instead turn that line and put an arrow on one end, you know, and it's like, go this way.
Mm-hmm.
And then that begins to call us toward something. So let's just say tithing is, you know, 10%. And then we ask, well,
is that gross or net?
As soon as we talk about tithing, right, what comes up? Is it gross or net? Is it on this? You know, I got a bonus.
I need to know.
Right? Is it on this bonus? Should I tithe on this non-liquid item that I've received?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, what kinds of... What,
that's
what
keeping of law.
Someone to ask that question?
Yeah, I want
to
make sure I don't get in trouble with God.
Right.
And I don't really care to do any more than what he requires.
Exactly. Right. So does tithing make people generous?
No.
Right. And so that's, you know, and I think that's why tithing is never mentioned in the New Testament except by Jesus in a derogatory sense toward the Pharisees, right? But Christians are never called to tithe. Paul instead gives people reason to give. Your brother is poor, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has a need. Take up his, you know, take up his burden, carry it with him. That the Lord loves a cheerful giver, right? Mm-hmm. That there's something about this relationship and this connection with God that ought to call someone toward ever growing generosity, you know? And we're going to talk about that because there are a lot of elements or aspects or facets, as I'm calling it, to the gospel that encourage generosity. And it's not just one motivation, one instinct, but as we turn that diamond, and for many years I've thought about the gospel as a diamond, something small, beautiful, rare, elegant, worth retaining. But as you turn it, it will cast a new light into a different, you know, different direction. As the light goes through a different facet, it comes out at a different color.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so each of these colors, these hues that the gospel brings is a new ethical light to see something in, okay? And so the gospel might say to us, well, we are all of one body, and when my brother suffers, I suffer too. Well, that makes me more generous, you know? Or it might say that we are all together in an army, and we are gaining ground, we are conquering people for Christ. We're taking them captive. And here's somebody who's called to be an evangelist, right? And we say, I want to participate in that. I want to see the kingdom advance. So sure, I'm sharing the faith at work and stuff. But also this guy is manifestly called to share it full time. You know, I think about Paul and his missionary journeys, and he would travel with a group of guys. And it seems obvious to me that those guys would show up in town with him, they would immediately get day labor jobs, and that would fund Paul's ministry largely. You know, that it wasn't so much that because they just didn't have the infrastructure for somebody to send funds to somebody, but, you know, you just go and you stay at an extended stay. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen work crews that will go and they'll stay in a hotel for a week and the trucks are parked there and they're kind of living communally. They're working together all day. They come back and they're drinking beer all mm-hmm. night and then they go back and work, right? I'm not trying to stereotype somebody. I'm just thinking about a recent experience that we had. At any rate, there are places like that. So if you can imagine, let's just say that there's a group of single guys who are just on fire for Jesus. You know, and one of them seems obviously called and has an apostleship or, you know, some kind of anointing for that. But the other ones, maybe some of them have more of a servant's heart. Somebody has some very marketable skills. And they decide, you know, God just really called them to go to the city. And they go. Man, how easy would it be for them just to load up in a car, drive, move into an extended stay, work through the day. They have plenty of money, be communal, pray together at night, and, you know, debrief through the night. Do ministry together. You know, I was just thinking about this the other day, and so shower thoughts, right? How easy would that be if that was our model? You know, if singleness wasn't something that was to be avoided like the plague, if you didn't have to be front and center, you were okay to just be like, you know what, I can earn more money than you can. I'm going to work, and you're going to preach, you know, mm-hmm. and we're going to debrief through the day. And if you screw around all day, then I'm going to kick your butt because I love you, you know, mm-hmm. and not literally, but you know what I'm saying. We'll hold each other accountable. You know, just think about how powerful that would be to do and just say, hey, you know, we're going to be in the city for a while. We're going to try to reach some strategic spots. If it doesn't work, you know, we're going to be there for 3 months. And if it doesn't work, we're going to move on and we're going to find where God's opened some doors. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, think about how effective that would be. But it only works if your heart has been so touched by the gospel that your vocational life is only a reason and only, you know, your ability to earn is only about spreading the gospel. You know, now you've become very generous. You're like, half of everything I earn out there is yours, you know, because we're only earning enough for both of us to live on. And that's, you know, I can't like keep from you. I can't think of it as mine. Mm-hmm. But you see how the gospel begins to change someone's view of their what they're earning, their possessions and stuff. And if it really does, if we're not thinking in terms of just giving, you know, on charity or percentage, you know, a lot of times I think people will support a minister and they'll think of it as charity, you know, and it's kind of like, well, is that what it is? I mean, if it is, then you probably should quit giving money to that person because that person's perfectly able-bodied and they just need to get a job. If you don't believe in the gospel enough and you don't believe in what they're doing enough to support them, then they need to get a job. If you think of it as charity, if you're like, well, you know, I gave you this much money and now I see that you've, you know, you bought yourself a new phone and that was my money. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Yeah, that miserliness is still there. That's what needs to change. But again, this is the difference between some sort of ethic by rote, like you need to give to, you know, X, Y, and Z, and people feel obligated to do that. But then we're still holding on to it. You know, it's not, we don't see it as belonging to all of us, but the gospel should change that. It should repolarize our drives. And if it's not, then we need to go back to it. We need to consult it. But that's the difference, I think, between law keeping, lawlessness, and under the law of Christ. Okay. So there's really only three options in my what I can see. You know, you can be under some sort of prescriptive law. You can be lawless in terms of, you know, this is just whatever suits me. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a lot of lawless people in the world who would not, are not in prison. mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
there are people who they're just shrewd enough to know you got to be nice to this person because they have influence, mm-hmm. you know, and you don't want to talk bad about that person because it'll get back to that person. That approach is still lawless. It's still about me. Mm-hmm. And so at any rate, the gospel calls us away from that to something more. And I think that maybe a lot of people who are under a prescriptive system are even lawless in every other element and aspect of their life. You know, they'll still tell somebody what they want to hear instead of what they need to hear, but then they'll give their 10% and, you know, stuff like that. So I wanted to read a passage in 1 Corinthians 9 because Paul's kind of threading this needle, okay? He says, though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Hmm. Right? Now, just think about that right there. What does that suggest about Paul's ethical matrix? I'll read it again. Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. What do you think?
Well, yeah, he's like, I've given up adhering to the Jewish law and fitting in with the Jews and conforming to Judaism. Mm-hmm. I'm free from that.
Right.
And yet now I'm following the example of Christ, who became a slave to Philippians 2 to win the world. And now that's my new example to follow. That's my new law, which is this law of love and just giving myself over for the salvation of everyone.
Right. Yeah. And I think love for Christ, this idea that, you know, that the lamb who was slain might receive the reward for his suffering. That there's it, if you boil it down, really, we could say he made himself a slave because he wants to. And someone who makes himself a slave because they want to is always free, even though they are a slave. And so now he goes into the details of what does that look like? Okay. So he said to the Jews, to your point, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. You know, so here's somebody who is so free that he can adhere to the law. Okay. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law.
Yeah. I'm not free from the law. I mean, I'm free from the law. I'm not free from God's law.
Right.
He distinguishes God's law from the Jewish law.
Right.
So I'm still under God, under his authority.
Right.
And God has this law, which is, I think he says, the law of Christ.
Right. So he... Notice that he's placing himself in a third category. Like until this time, there's only been two categories, really. There's been the Jew and the Gentile, right? Those under the law, those not under the law, okay? And Paul's saying that I am neither, and because I am neither, I can relate to both for their sake, because that Christ's law, I think, is predicated, it runs underneath and behind all of this, and that is seeking the best for these people, trying to win them for him. I mean, that's at least a part of it, right? And so he is, he's a third order, and so are you, and so am I, and so is anyone who belongs to Christ. But if we relinquish that standing and we begin to conform conscientiously to prescriptive law, then we retreat back into this dichotomy that really, I think, is dangerous for the world, and that we will always be on either side of this great divide, whereas Jesus, the Prince of Peace, is calling everyone out from their categories to join him in a new one that transcends and defies the others. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. So there's this approach, right? So he's under this law of Christ. One element of this law of Christ, one facet, is the promotion of the saving message. you know, that, and so what will promote it? I mean, you just begin to ask that, you know, every time you take one of these facets up, you think, well, that's it. If I just do that, then I'm going to, you know, mm-hmm. What you'll find is that you really need the whole gospel. You know, it's not like every one of them stands so alone, so powerful, it shines so brightly ethically that every time you think this is all I need to know, but you'll invariably find something where you need a different angle. You know, yes, if I just live for the sake of the gospel and promoting the gospel, that's probably going to solve a lot of issues, right? But then it might cause me to have a public life and a private life. Okay? So then there's something missing. So if I could say, I do everything for the sake of the gospel, and so I'm going to, you know, that's going to affect how I look at money, like we just talked about. It's going to affect how I look at, you know, my relationships outside of the church, how it affects the way I'm perceived by this set of people or that set of people, right? I'm going to try to behave in such a way that's going to cast the gospel in the best possible light for the audience that I'm trying to reach. And that's going to affect a lot. It's going to keep me from doing some bad stuff and everything else, right? But it also could possibly make me publicly one way and privately another. And so that would be a concern. Okay. Interestingly enough, Paul follows this directly with a more private ethic from the gospel. He says, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others," this is that public life, "I myself will not be disqualified for the prize." That's the private life. So the other ethic I think we find in this and this law of Christ as it's just running behind everything he says and does is this concern over corruption in the flesh and the need to maintain the physical drives as subordinate to our greater goals, right? Our longing for Christ, our longing for home. You know, we could call this facet the coming kingdom. We could call this facet the holiness drive, the spiritual drive that... And I was just reading this the other day is in 1 Corinthians 2, where Paul is talking about becoming a spiritual person. And he's saying, look, God is invisible. He can't be perceived by your senses. And if you're a sensual person, you are making yourself so that you cannot perceive God. That seems very clear what he's saying in 1 Corinthians 2. And so, you know, he's saying, you guys have set up human leaders. Why would you do that? Because you can see them, touch them, hear them. You're being fleshly. That's what he says in 1 Corinthians 3. He says, I can speak to you as spirit, like you're spiritual people. He says, I'm trying to become a spiritual person. Other people around are becoming spiritual people. Why? Because Scripture says, things that eye has not seen, ear has not heard, nor entered into the heart of man, God, those things that God has prepared for those who love him. You want those things? You can't be all about what you see and what you hear and what you think. You have to be about something spiritual. You have to conform to the leading of the Holy Spirit. You have to contend with your flesh. The spirit and the flesh are antagonistic in this reality that we live in, right? And that there is a perceptual organ that humans are supposed to have, but you cannot use it if all you do is listen to your flesh. So that's a consequential kind of a approach. It's saying, look, you can't be a fleshly person and not pay a price in terms of your spiritual perception. Now, do you want what God has? Do you want eternal life? You know, in Galatians 6, he says, look, God's not mocked. The one that, you know, you will reap what you sow, right? If you sow to the flesh, you will reap decay. Why? Because the body's decaying. You know, if you give your time and treasure and attention to what's going to make your physical self more comfortable or better off or happier or whatever, then you're going to reap decay. That's just obvious, right? Decay not just in terms of an aging body or a dead and rotting body, but in terms of decay of our self. Because he's already talked right there in the previous chapter. He says, if you give yourself over to the flesh, he says, walk by the Spirit, you will not fulfill the lust of the flesh, right? And because the flesh lusts against the Spirit against the flesh to keep you from doing what you want. That's a state of decay. Okay, that's when the whole person is being disintegrated into a state of decay. And he's saying, if you give yourself to the flesh, you're going to decay. And he says, if you sow to the Spirit, from the Spirit, you will reap life, everlasting life, life that is invigorating and it is increasing. And these dynamics cannot be violated, which gets to this private morality, right? So you see that the gospel, we've kind of audited, and we're going to look at a couple of the facets more in detail. But Paul definitely had a law, right? Mm-hmm. It just wasn't rules predicated on reward and punishment. It is the difference between legislated law, let's say, the laws of the United States of America, working in selling wastewater treatment equipment, I have to be aware of
regulations,
state's administrative code,
yeah,
right? And so TAC 217 dot, 32 sub B, I had to be aware of that, okay? Now, those laws prescribe the way certain things are supposed to be designed and installed if you're going to put them in the state of Texas, okay? But those laws are predicated on other laws, and those other laws are natural laws. So, sewer water, I know this is kind of weird, but, it has a certain quality to it that's true almost anywhere you go within certain parameters, okay? And if that's released, then there will be certain consequences no matter where you go. Mm-hmm. And nobody needs to legislate that. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of laws, they undergird that, but they transcend it. They're self-enforcing. Now, if you have somebody who is like, I know that that's going to be a problem, but what I'm discharging isn't going to disrupt the environment. So it's too expensive. I'm going to not worry about it. Okay, that's lawlessness. Mm-hmm. That's somebody doing what's good for them without concern for other people. Mm-hmm. But even if there were no legislated law, the person could still be lawless, mm-hmm, by not being concerned for others. Mm-hmm. Okay, not being beholden to any sort of behavioral standard for themselves or accountability. Mm-hmm. That's a lawless approach. Now, somebody who maybe their heart has changed and they just have a real love for the environment. They're just very concerned about what happens downstream, and they just couldn't live with themselves. Like, what they want is for their home and their environment, their surroundings to be better for their children. That's just their drive, their instinct. Now, does that person need that administrative code in order to be governed by law, by a law, right?
Right, right. There is a law within.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's a big biblical theme, is that God's going to put the law within our hearts.
Right.
And then we're going to be inwardly directed,
right,
by this love.
Right. And so, I want to caution, I think, whoever may be listening out there, that what we can tend to do is, if we are only in relationship with the prescriptive law, with the administrative code, we can fail to recognize the undergirding law, right? The natural law, the law of consequence, okay? And become lawless, because what we're thinking is, how can I get away with violating this prescriptive law? Because the prescriptive law has to be enforced, and if the cop's not there, you can go undetected, then you do it, mm-hmm, right? Because everybody else has to keep it, maybe, and I don't have to worry about it because somebody else is not as smart as I am, so let them deal with the consequences, but I'm not going to worry about it. And so, focusing on the prescriptive law, because it's laying on top. It's obvious someone's going to hold you accountable or whatever. It's immediate in the sense that, you know, legislative authorities have to catch you before it really turns into an ecological disaster. You know, so people tend to respond to that first. But that becomes very dangerous from a personal development standpoint, because then you have people who don't have an intrinsic longing to do what's best. Mm-hmm. And so your society begins to degrade, as your individuals degrade, and it becomes too expensive to enforce law on people who don't connect the dots and don't have an intrinsic drive. And that obviously becomes dangerous for the individual and the society. But religiously, this is why we cannot allow ourselves to go back to prescriptive law. It's why Paul avoided it like the plague, even though the consequences of avoiding law appeared maybe too much, too high a cost to pay, because they dealt with heresies and sects that broke off and taught, you know, hedonism and license and, you know, just this indulgence of the flesh. And you can see it in Scripture as they're trying to counter this and say, man, you missed it altogether. Mm-hmm. But they still don't go back to this prescriptive approach because they know it's what Jesus saved us from.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so we'll get into it next week. We'll continue the discussion then. It's not under law, but it's not lawless.
Right.
And there's a new law within. This is the new covenant.
It is.
That God has fulfilled in Christ. Okay, guys, thanks. If you got questions, you can always email us, discussion@recoverfaith.org. We will see you next time.